he looked up slowly into the face of La Santa Muerte, then called out to Spider. Cepeda shot out of the scrum of his men down in the sala and up the three steps to the raised dining hall.
See, Don Daniel, do you think the gringo really got the phone number he called today from Jerry Flager?
No.
Calvo gave him that number because he knew his agents were monitoring it. The old bastard is as cunning as they come.
DLR nodded.
Yes, he is very cunning.
Spider stood dutifully over his master. DLR turned and looked up to him.
I want everyone staying behind, ready for action tonight.
Spider nodded, confused.
Of course.
Daniel stood and left the dining room through the curtains, heading for his master's suite in the back of the mansion. A cluster of small, uninhabited islands sit in Banderas Bay, just a few hundred yards off of Mismaloya, collectively called Los Arcos. They are named for the arch-like formations carved out of the rock by centuries of pounding surf. During the day, the protected marine reserve around Los Arcos was full of scuba divers, snorkelers, and pleasure boats, but 1 hour before midnight, the only creatures in the water around the tiny islands were fish, lobster, sleeping blue-footed boobies, and other seabirds. 50 yards closer to shore, a pair of private boats bobbed in the water. In each boat, four men sat with M16 rifles in their laps. Two men in each boat had an M203 grenade launcher mounted on their M16s. Each boat also had a radio and a 2 million candle power flashlight to scan the calm water in all directions. They were hardly battleships, but the two converted gunboats would certainly present an obstacle for anyone trying to make it to the back of Casa de las Olas from the water. Court gentry knelt waist-deep in water that was surging back and forth in the black recesses of a small grotto in one of the rocks of Los Arcos. His eyes looked past the two small boats and towards the white sand beach beyond them. A pair of men with flashlights strolled back and forth on the sand, rifles hanging on their backs. A wall of white boulders and brown shale ran up to the right of the small beach. Past the men, past the beach, up the hill, he scanned the palatial estate. It looked a bit like a space station. It was a modern glass and steel structure, all hard metal edges and glass walls. The focal point of the back of the house was a balcony that ran along a gargantuan window. On the other side of the glass, Court could just make out dim lighting, perhaps from candles. Much of the grounds of the property were well lit and, Court assumed, well protected. But from here, the building itself seemed buttoned up and quiet. On the highest point of the southern wing of the huge mansion, a black Eurocopter EC-135 sat in complete darkness. Only the few street lights and glowing buildings higher on distant hills framed its silhouette. Court took a few minutes to deflate his small rubber boat and to tuck it into a dry nook in the grotto out of sight of the coast. Then he turned to his equipment arrayed on a rocky shelf just above the waterline. He donned his scuba gear and his fins, slung a long coiled rope to his tank, connected his Glock to his buoyancy control device, and attached his bag of clothing, extra magazines, and other items to his utility belt. He pulled a mobile phone out of a protected case, powered it up, and made a phone call. Court said what he had to say, then hung up as the man on the other end screamed and cussed. The phone went back in the case went back in the bag. At 20 minutes past 11 p.m., Court sank slowly below the water in the grotto, pushed off with his gloved hands, kicked his legs, and began swimming away from Los Arcos and towards the shore. He passed the two boats 20 minutes later, traveling 60 feet below them and breathing as slowly and as shallowly as he could to minimize bubbles above. 20 minutes after that, he was below the surf. The ocean floor crept up towards the beach. Each wave that surged him forward was followed by an undertow that pulled him back, but he kicked to maximize his progress and, after 10 minutes of heavy exercise, he worked his way ashore. He'd let the current push him south of the lights of the building, south of the beach and into the rocks. He took off his scuba gear, turned off his tank, and stowed it between boulders at the water's edge. He pulled off his fins and his clammy wetsuit. Underneath his neoprene, he was dressed head to toe in black cotton. He slipped into soft-soled shoes, pulled a black ski mask over his face, put his extra magazines in the cargo pockets of his pants and a black Glock into the holster on his belt. At midnight, he began climbing up the rock, careful to stay out of view of the sentries on the beach, the spotlights from the boats, or any guards in the windows of the house. His progress was slow and arduous, but he made it to the south side of the villa and then proceeded silently to the front, careful to move in shadow and concealment. Daniel de la Rocha knelt before his throned idol in the candlelit dining room. The huge high-ceilinged main sala of the villa was open and empty behind him. Both rooms were illuminated by the light of over 100 white candles, as well as a little ambient light that filtered through the sala's window overlooking the bay. On the floor, on tables, on wall sconces, on tall narrow stands, the burning candles emanated not just light, but pungent aromatic wax as well. DLR was bare-chested, his lean and muscular body adorned with tattoos. The large Santa Muerte on his chest in red and black and blue, the names of his six children in ornate script across his back, guns on his biceps, army unit patches across his midsection, the names of dead black suit colleagues wherever a clean space of physique had been found to inscribe them. He remained kneeling in supplication, all alone in the candlelit room, until slowly his head rose. He did not turn around as he said in English,
"She told me you would come."
No one responded to this comment. DLR then said,
"You knew that we were monitoring that telephone line. You had us send our Sicarios to Concordia to get them away from here."
The reply came now, the voice firm and authoritative.
"You move a fucking muscle, and I'll blow your head all over your girlfriend's dress."
The gray man moved silently closer across the white tile of the large sala, his Glock pointed at the back of Daniel de la Rocha's head. As soon as he realized there was a second-story balcony overlooking the sala, he spun on the balls of his feet, swung his weapon along the sightline, and scanned quickly for threats above. But it was black and quiet on the balcony, just as it was here in the sala, and ahead in what Court could only imagine had been an open dining room before DLR converted it into a throne room for a silly skeleton statue.
"May I stand?"
"Slowly. First, thread your fingers behind your head." DLR complied. Court closed to within 20 feet or so, but he kept his eyes darting around, confused by the lack of protection for the narco boss in front of him.
"May I turn around?"
DLR asked. He seemed calm. Court jacked his head and his weapon back to his 6 o'clock position, then up again to the balcony on his left and behind him. Empty, dark, quiet and empty.
"Slowly."
DLR turned, faced the gray man below him.
"She told me you would come."
"You said that. Where is Laura?"
"You did not give Nestor to Madrigal."
"No, I did not." DLR smiled a little.
"The cowboy is going to be mad at you."
Court was all business.
"Where's the girl?"
He spun around again, kept his weapon's muzzle moving in a blur as he scanned all around.
"You would like to exchange my Nestor for your Laura, correct?"
"That's correct. You can have him back, and then Laura and I will leave together. Everyone wins." De La Rocha just shrugged. Court began stepping backwards, hoping to make his way to a wall so his back would not be exposed to the balcony behind him. As Gentry backed into a sofa in the middle of the floor, De La Rocha said,
"Nestor told you his men were monitoring the phone line, and that is why you called it."
Court did not respond.
"Nestor gave you this address as well. He has let me down by conspiring with you. He let me down more by working with Madrigal in the first place, going behind my back to make a deal for you. I found out all about it this afternoon, and as a result of this knowledge, your bargaining chip has lost all its value."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, if you had brought Calvo with you tonight, I would have killed him myself."
Court started moving sideways along the long couch.
"So you see, amigo, you come here with nothing to trade for the girl."
Court's brain worked through the problem. He said,
"There is something." "What's that?"
"In exchange for her life, you can have me. She walks out right now, we stand around and look at each other until I know that she's safe, and then I lower my gun. Me for her.
Okay?" "One problem with your offer."
"What's that?"
"I already have you."
Court heard the footsteps above and behind him. A dozen men stepped onto the balcony. Six filed over to his left, and six stayed behind. He assumed they'd been watching the conversation on a closed-circuit television. They all carried M4 rifles. Fuck. 55.
I did not send all of my Sicarios to Concordia. In fact, this is not all of them. I actually retained the leader of my enforcement arm, just in case I needed his help this evening.
DLR looked to his left.
Spider?
The curtain to the left of the throne opened. Behind it, Spider stood in his black suit. His arms were high in the air, and they held a long, shining machete. Below him, on her knees, handcuffed and gagged, knelt Laura Gamboa. She looked to Court down in the sala, and then she strained against her bindings. Court's weapon turned to Cepeda's forehead.
You move that blade and I drop you.
His voice quivered and cracked as he spoke. DLR laughed at him.
Think about it, amigo. You shoot Spider, and then all the men around here fill you with machine gun bullets. And then, as you lay dead or dying, I step over and chop her head off myself.
Daniel unlaced his fingers and dropped them down to his sides.
I know what the most difficult thing for you right now is, gringo. It is not saving her, not killing me, not getting away with your life. No, Gray Man. The most difficult thing at this moment is trying to not think of the phrase Mexican standoff.
He laughed at his joke.
We can work this out, Daniel. In just a few minutes, this—
Quiet!
DLR shouted, then turned behind him, opened the curtain, and slid out a small trunk. He opened it and lifted an item out. It was a black plastic bag, and Court immediately suspected it contained a human head. He was right. Daniel pulled it out and held it high above him. Court focused on the disgusting sight, stared at the face.
Elena?
No. It was a man.
Ramses?
No. The hair was lighter. The flickering candlelight from 100 sources could not bring life to the open, vacant eyes. Court's jaw clenched. He said aloud,
Jerry. Spider Sicarios caught your American friend yesterday trying to board a cruise ship in Cancun. Under torture, we found out the Gamboas crossed the border in Nogales and made it to Tucson. You were smart to not tell him more of their plans. Flager was weak. Still, they worked on him all night before they determined he didn't know where you were.
So, Jerry didn't know where Elena went. He was ultimately useless.
DLR tossed the American embassy man's head across the room, towards the huge windows off to Court's right. It rolled into a dark corner and disappeared.
I need Elena Gamboa. I offered the life of little Laura here to La Virgen, but she only laughed. I offered her your life, but she told me your death would serve me, not her, and therefore it is no gift at all.
Court's eyes scanned the room again while DLR said this. Other than the doorway he'd passed through to enter the sala, there was one more entrance visible, an archway on his left that, no doubt, led to the front of the house. He suspected there was another archway behind the curtains in the dining room. That would lead towards the south wing of the huge building. He wasn't sure why any of this mattered, as the dozen dudes who had him in their sights would cut him in half if he made for any of the exits. DLR said,
So, I will make you this one offer. You tell me where Elena is hiding. I will send my men there, and as soon as we get her, I will let Laura leave. Keep me. I will tell you.
DLR shook his head. He seemed almost weary with the discussion.
No deal.
He turned to Spider.
Are your arms getting tired?
Spider kept them high over his head.
Sí, jefe.
It won't be long now, my friend.
He looked at Court.
Your decision. Does she live or die?
Laura's big brown eyes looked up at Court. She was gagged with black cloth, but she chewed at it and tried to stand up. Spider held her down with one hand, kept the machete over her, ready to slice through the back of her sinewy neck. Outside in the distance, there was the unmistakable sound of a Kalashnikov rifle firing fully automatic. All bodies in the room stiffened at the noise. Another weapon kicked in a second later. They were a couple hundred yards away, but the volume of fire increased. Car alarms in the neighborhood began sounding off.
Who is it? DLR asked Gentry. Madrigal's men?
Court shrugged. He knew that it was, but the longer he could instill doubt, the better.
Probably CIA. Outside chance, it's the Russian mob.
Court knew it was Los Vaqueros because he had contacted Hector Cerna himself while in the grotto at Los Arcos. Court told him he could find Calvo at this address. Cerna had screamed at him about the change of plans, but Court hung up before listening to much of the man's anger. DLR started to show concern as the AK fire continued. He barked an order to Spider.
Keep five here. Send everyone else to the perimeter. Have the pilot ready my chopper.
Spider shouted an order to the men on the balcony, and then another order into a walkie-talkie on his belt. All but five of the gunmen disappeared, and those who remained all moved to the eastern balcony. They kept their rifles trained on the gray man as they did so. DLR had returned to the trunk from which he pulled Flager's head. Now he retrieved a large gun belt. A pair of silver 45 automatic pistols hung from it. He buckled the belt around his waist, tied the holsters around the thighs of his black slacks, and looked back up at the gray man.
You force my hand, fool.
Court turned his gun away from Spider and back towards DLR.
You give the order to Spider, and I kill you first.
Daniel laughed.
Typical cocky gringo. You are one man with a pistol. If I give the order to Spider, you won't have a chance to shoot any.
A loud explosion just outside the house sent small snowflakes of stucco from the ceiling. All heads turned towards the noise, except one. Court remained focused on his targets, even while his mind raced. Damn it. Court didn't like his chances, but he saw no other option. He had one trick up his sleeve, though, and he'd have to play it for all it was worth. The gun in his hand looked exactly like a Glock 17, a common semi-automatic pistol. Surely DLR, Spider, and all the gunmen on the balcony had already identified it as such. But it was a Glock 18. The two weapons appear virtually identical, but the 18 is a rare handgun capable of fully automatic fire. Its ported barrel is able to spew 9mm bullets at a rate of 1,200 rounds per minute. Court thought it over in an instant, working on a plan of attack. Spider and his machete over Laura's neck would have to go first. There were no two ways around that. The men high on Court's left also wore Kevlar suits, just like their boss, and Court's 9mm rounds would not penetrate Kevlar, so he'd either have to sweep across all five with perfectly executed headshots, or at least knock them back a bit with a round or two into their soft armor and then finish them off after reloading. DLR wasn't pointing a weapon at him, as were the Sicarios on his left, but his 2.45s would be in the fight in under 2 seconds. Court would have to execute an emergency reload of the Glock with perfect speed and precision, all the while avoiding the fire of any of the men with the M4s who'd survived his initial barrage. 18 rounds of ammunition fired in full automatic mode at a rate of 1,200 rounds per minute. His gun would be empty in a half second. Oh yeah, there was one more factor Gentry knew he'd need to bring to bear. As soon as he started shooting, reflex alone would send rounds from the enemy rifles right where he was standing. In order to have any chance at survival, he'd have to execute all this precision while diving out of the way, moving his body as quickly as possible from where the five weapons were aiming. Court felt confident there was no one on this earth with a better chance at executing this. Still, he put his chances at survival at less than 25%. In the gun world, this was referred to as a spray and pray. Gentry was about to do both. 56.
Where is Elena Gamboa?
DLR shouted this time. Another explosion just outside the mansion. Apparently, Los Vaqueros had brought along a few RPGs. DLR said,
Spider, if he doesn't answer in 5 seconds, kill the puta.
Court took a deep breath, blew it out, looked at Laura, and then back at DLR. He lowered the pistol from Daniel De La Rocha's tattooed chest. DLR immediately began reaching for the silver 45s on his belt. Time to act. Once the 45s were trained on him, the equation would be unsolvable. In the dim light of the sala, Court lifted his pistol in a blur, shifted his aim to the right, remained in place on his feet, and pressed the trigger on the Glock 18. As the pistol lined up on the nose of Spider Cepeda, it popped, and a single round left the barrel behind smoke and fire. With no hesitation or delay to check the results of his shot, Cort spun his entire torso hard to the left, his knees went slack, and he dropped straight down towards the tile in front of the sofa. For 0.002 seconds, his weapon was trained on the bare chest of Daniel De La Rocha, but he did not fire. DLR was at the bottom of his threat matrix, his pistol